Manners? Alessia gives him a venomous look and sits up, rubbing her fists in her eyes. Get out. We'll spend the night here. He doesn't offer her his hand this time, but reaches in and grabs his coat from her and slips it on. The biting wind wraps around her and she shivers. She aches everywhere, but she climbs out of the trunk and, feeling gloomy, stands to one side, waiting for his next move. Anatoly's gaze follows her, and his lips press into a thin, angry line. Feeling a little more docile now? He sneers. Alessia says nothing. He snorts and reaches for their luggage. Alessia glances around. They are in a parking lot in the center of a city. An imposing hotel looms in the near distance. It's several stories high and lit up like a Hollywood movie, with the word Westin crowning its facade. Abruptly, Anatoly grabs her hand and tugs her toward the entrance. He doesn't break his stride, so she has to scurry to keep up. The foyer is all marble, mirrors, and modernity, and Alessia spots the discreet sign. They are in the Westin, Zagreb. Anatoly checks them into the hotel in what sounds like flawless Croatian, and a few minutes later they are riding up to the 15th floor in the elevator. Anatoly has booked them a luxurious suite that is furnished in creams and browns. There's a couch, a desk, and a small table, and through the sliding doors, Alessia can see one bed. One. No! She remains standing, tired and helpless, just within the threshold. Anatoly shrugs off his coat and throws it onto the couch. Are you hungry? He asks, opening the doors of the dresser beneath the TV. Eventually, he finds the minibar. Well? He snaps. Alessia nods. Anatoly motions with his head toward a leather-bound book on the desk. We'll get room service. Choose something. And take off your coat. Alessia picks up the book and leafs through the pages to the in-room dining section. The entries are in Croatian and English. She scans the selections and immediately chooses the most expensive item on the menu. She has no compunction about having Anatoly spend his money. She frowns, remembering how she resisted Maxim's attempts to pay. Anatoly has retrieved two small bottles of scotch and is unscrewing the top from each in turn. Yes, Alessia has no compunction at all. She's a kidnap victim, and he's meted out enough physical abuse on her body already. He owes her. But with Maxim, the balance was all wrong. She had owed him so much. Her mister. She lets him slip quietly from her mind, to be mourned later. I'll have the New York steak, she declares, with an extra salad and fries and a glass of red wine. Anatoly turns to regard her with surprise. Wine? Yes, wine. He considers her for a moment. You have become very Western. She stands taller. I would like a glass of French red wine. French now? He raises a brow. Yes. And as an afterthought, she adds, please. Okay, we'll get a bottle. He lifts his shoulder in a nonchalant shrug, and he sounds so reasonable. But he's not. He's a monster. He pours both whiskeys into a glass and watches her as he reaches for the phone. You know, you're a very attractive woman, Alessia. She freezes. What now? Are you still a virgin? His voice is soft, cajoling. She gasps and feels a little faint. Of course, she breathes, attempting to look outraged and embarrassed at once. He cannot know the truth. His gaze hardens. You seem different. I am. I've had my eyes opened. By someone? Just by my experiences, she whispers, wishing she had never responded. She's antagonizing a snake. Anatoly dials room service and orders their meal while Alessia removes her coat and sits down on the couch to watch him warily. When he finishes his call, he grabs the TV remote, switches on the local news, and sits at the desk with his drink. For a while, he watches the news, ignoring her, occasionally sipping his whiskey. Alessia is relieved that his attention is elsewhere. She watches the TV as well, trying to understand the newscaster, and she catches a few words. She concentrates. She doesn't want her mind to wander. It will only wander back to Maxim, and she refuses to grieve his loss in front of Anatoly. When the program is over, he turns his attention back to Alessia.
"So you ran away from me," he says.
"Is he talking about yesterday?"
"When you left Albania."
He takes a last swig of scotch.
"You threatened to break my fingers."
He rubs his chin, thoughtful for a moment.
"Alessia, I..."
He stops.
"I don't want excuses, Anatoly. There's no excuse for treating another human being the way you have treated me. Look at my neck."
She pulls down her sweater, revealing the bruises he left yesterday, and raises her chin, making them conspicuous. He flushes. There's a discreet knock on the door, and with a frustrated glance at Alessia, Anatoly retreats to open it. A young man dressed in West End livery is outside with a dining cart. Anatoly beckons him in and stands back as the server transforms the cart into a table. It's covered in a white linen tablecloth and plush place settings for two. There's a jaunty single yellow rose in a ceramic vase, striving to represent a little romance.
Ironic.
Alessia's sorrow surfaces, eating at her insides, and she has to fight back tears while the waiter opens the wine. Placing the cork in a ceramic dish, he pulls several plates from a warming drawer beneath the cart and removes their metallic covers with a flourish. The aroma is tantalizing. Anatoly says something in Croatian and slips the waiter what looks like a 10-euro note, for which he seems extremely grateful. Once the young man has left the room, Anatoly summons Alessia to the table.
"Come and eat."
He sounds like he's sulking. Because she's hungry and tired of fighting, Alessia sits down at the makeshift table. This is how it will be, a slow, grinding erosion of her will, so that in time she will submit to this man.
"This is most Western, yes?"
he says as he sits opposite her and picks up the bottle of wine. He pours her a glass. Alessia mulls over his earlier statement. If Anatoly wants a traditional Albanian wife, then that's what he will have. She will not eat with him, or sleep with him, except when he wants sex. Surely that's not really what he wants. She stares down at her dinner as the walls of the room close in, suffocating her.
"Gezuar, Alessia," he says,
and she looks up. Anatoly has raised his glass in a quiet salute to her, his eyes wide, his expression warm. Her scalp tingles. She wasn't expecting this. Honor. Picking up her glass, she offers it in a reluctant toast to him and takes a sip. She says, closing her eyes, seduced by the taste of the wine. When she reopens them, Anatoly is watching her, his eyes darkening, and in his gaze she sees a promise of something she doesn't want. Her appetite vanishes.
"You won't run from me again, Alessia. You will be my wife," he murmurs. "Now eat."
She stares down at the steak on her plate. Chapter 30. Anatoly refills her glass again.
"You've hardly touched your food."
"I'm not hungry."
"In that case, I think it's time we went to bed."
The tone of his voice makes her look up sharply. He's sitting back in his chair, watchful, waiting, like a predator. He taps his bottom lip with his index finger as if deep in thought, his eyes gleaming. He's had at least 3 glasses of wine, and the whiskey. He tosses the remaining contents of his glass down his throat and rises from his seat, slowly. His eyes on her, intense, darker. She's paralyzed by his stare.
"No.
I don't see why I should wait for our wedding night,"
He steps closer.
No, Anatoly, she breathes. Please, no.
She clutches the table. He runs a finger down her cheek.
Beautiful, he whispers. Get up.
Don't make this hard for both of us.
We should wait,
Alessia whispers, her brain churning through her options.
I don't want to wait. And if I have to fight you, so be it.
He moves suddenly, grabbing her by her shoulders and yanking her upright and out of her seat so forcefully that she knocks her chair to the floor. Fear and anger surge through her body. She twists and kicks, her foot striking his shin and then the table, rattling the crockery and cutlery and knocking over her glass so that it spills the remaining wine.
Ow! Fuck! He whines.
No!
She shouts, lashing out with both her feet, her fists flailing, hoping to strike him. He lunges at her and grabs her around the waist, jerking her into his arms. He lifts her off her feet while she kicks out at anything and everything in their path in an effort to strike him.
No, she screams. Please, Anatoly!
Ignoring her cries, he tightens his arms around her and half drags, half carries her into the bedroom.
No, no, stop!
Quiet,
he shouts as he shakes her and throws her face down onto the bed. He sits beside her, holding her still, pressing down on her back with one hand while the other starts tugging at her boots.
No!
She screams again. She twists, kicking him once, twice, trying to struggle out of his hold as she pummels him with her fists.
For fuck's sake, Alessia!
She's wild, her anger and loathing giving her a strength she didn't know she possessed. She fights, consumed by her rage and directing it at the man she hates.
Fucking hell!
Anatoly throws himself on top of her, crushing her into the mattress and knocking the breath from her body. She tries to buck him off, but he's too heavy.
Calm down, he pants in her ear. Calm down.
She stills, marshaling her resources and struggling to gulp air into her lungs. Anatoly shifts his weight and flips her over so that they're nose to nose. Keeping his leg over her thighs, he grabs her hands and pulls them above her head, pinning them there with one hand.
I want you. You are my wife.
Please, no,
she whispers, staring into his wild, wide eyes. In them she sees his excitement. His lean body vibrates with it. She feels it against her hip. He stares down at her, breathing hard, and one of his hands moves over her body, over her breast and belly, to her fly.
No, Anatoly, please. I'm bleeding. Please, I'm bleeding.
She's lying, but it's a last desperate attempt to stop him. He frowns, as if not understanding, and then his expression changes from lust to distaste.
Oh, he says.
Releasing her hands, he rolls off her and stares up at the ceiling.
Maybe we should wait,
he grumbles. Alessia twists onto her side, drawing up her knees and curling into a ball, making herself as small as possible. Despair, revulsion, fear, these are her bedfellows now. Her tears start to choke her, and she feels the bed move as Anatoly rises and walks back into the living room. How long can she cry before her tears dry up? Moments, seconds, hours. Later, Anatoly drapes a blanket over her. She feels the bed dip as he climbs in beneath the covers. He shuffles over, wraps his arm around her, and tugs her unyielding body closer.
You will suit me well, carissima, he murmurs, and his lips brush her cheek in a surprisingly gentle kiss.
Alessia puts her fist to her mouth, stifling her silent scream. She wakes suddenly. The room is in semi-darkness, lit only by the gray light of the coming dawn. Beside her, Anatoly is fast asleep. His face is relaxed and less stern in repose. Alessia stares at the ceiling, her mind on full alert. She's still dressed and wearing her boots. She could run.
Go, now,
she wills herself. Slowly, stealthily, she rolls off the bed and tiptoes out of the room. The detritus of their meal from the previous night is still on the table. Alessia eyes the cold fries, hastily grabs a few and stuffs them into her mouth. While she eats, she rummages through her bag and finds her money. She slips the notes into her back pocket. She stops and listens. He's still asleep. Beside her duffel, she spies Anatoly's suitcase. Maybe he keeps his money in there. If he does, it could help her escape. Carefully, she unzips it, not knowing what she'll find inside. It's neatly packed. There are some clothes. And his gun. The gun. She fishes it out. She could kill him before he kills her. Her heart starts pounding and her head begins to spin. She has the power, the means. The pistol is weighty in her hand. Standing up, she sidles toward the bedroom door and watches Anatoly sleep. He hasn't moved. A tremor runs up her spine and her breathing shallows. He's kidnapped her, beaten her, choked her, nearly raped her. She despises him and everything he stands for. She's terrified of him. She raises her trembling hand and takes aim. Quietly, she releases the safety. Her head is throbbing, sweat beating on her brow. This is it. Her moment. Her hand wobbles and her vision blurs with her tears. No, 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 no. She dashes them away and drops her hand. She's not a murderer. She turns the gun around and stares down the barrel. She's seen enough American television to know what to do. She doesn't want to blindly accept her fate. This is one way out. She could end it all now. Her misery would be over. She will feel nothing ever again. Her mother's anguished face comes to her mind. Mama, how devastated would she be? She thinks of Maxim and dismisses the thought of him immediately. She'll never see him again. Her throat is closing, choked with emotion. She screws up her eyes, panting. She can die at her own hand, not Anatoly's. And someone will have to clean up afterward. No, no, no. She crumbles to the floor, defeated, a failure. She cannot take her own life. She doesn't have the gumption. And deep down, she wants to stay alive in the vague hope of seeing Maxim again. She can't run. She needs to get home. Zagreb is not 5 days' walk from London. It's so much farther. She's helpless. She rocks quietly to and fro, holding herself and cradling the gun while she silently surrenders to her grief. She's never been so distraught. She's never wept this many tears, ever. Even after her traumatic escape and on her long walk to Magda's, she'd mourned her grandmother and felt her loss, but she never felt this desolate. The sorrow is overwhelming. She cannot kill him, and she cannot kill herself. She's lost the man she loves, and she's bound to a man she loathes. Her heart is broken. No, her heart has disappeared. As the sun peaks over the horizon, she stifles her sobs, and through her tears, she examines the gun. It's similar to one of her father's. There is something she can do. She's seen her father do it often enough. She unclips the magazine and is surprised to find only 4 bullets in it. She removes them and then sharply pulls the slide back and catches the remaining round as it's ejected from the chamber. She reloads the magazine into the gun and pockets the bullets. Then she places the pistol back in Anatoly's case and zips it up. Standing, she wipes away her tears. Enough with the crying, she scolds herself. She glances toward the window as the skyline of Zagreb materializes in the early morning light. From the 15th floor of the Westin Hotel, the city is spread out beneath like a terracotta patchwork quilt. It's an arresting vista, and in a distracted moment, she wonders if Tirana is similar. You're awake, Anatoly's voice startles her.
I was hungry.
She glances at the table of leftover food. Now I'm going to have a shower. Grabbing her bag, she scuttles into the bathroom and locks the door. When she emerges, Anatoly is up and dressed. Their crockery and the leftover food have been cleared away, and there's fresh linen on the table, with a continental breakfast laid out for them.
You stayed,
Anatoly says quietly. He seems subdued, though he's as watchful as ever.
Where would I go? Alessia replies wearily.
He shrugs.
You left once before.
Alessia stares at him, mute, despondent, exhausted.
Is it because you care for me?
He whispers.
Don't flatter yourself, she says, and sitting down, picks out a pan au chocolat from the bread basket.
He takes his seat opposite her, and she can tell he's hiding a slight and hopeful smile.
Tom and I wander across the vast Skanderbeg Square, which is close to the hotel. It's a clear, chill morning, with the sun reflecting off the multicolored marble tiles that pave the gargantuan space. It's dominated on one side by a bronze statue of Albania's 15th century hero on horseback, and on the other by the National History Museum. Although I'm anxious to get to Alessia's town and find her home, we have to wait to meet our interpreter. I'm unsettled and jittery and unable to keep still. So to kill time, Tom and I take a quick walk through the museum. I distract myself by snapping numerous photographs and posting the odd one online. I get told off twice, but I ignore the officials and continue to take photographs surreptitiously. It's hardly the British Museum, but I'm fascinated by the Illyrian artifacts. Tom, of course, is preoccupied with the displays of medieval weaponry. Albania has a rich and bloody history. At 10, we stroll down one of the tree-lined boulevards toward the coffee house where we've arranged to meet our translator. I'm struck by how many men are sitting around drinking coffee outside, even though it's cold. Where are the women? Thanas Seka is dark-haired and dark-eyed, a post-grad student at the University of Tirana doing his doctorate in English literature. His English is excellent. He has a ready smile and an easygoing nature, and he's brought his girlfriend. Her name is Drita, and she's an undergrad studying history. She's petite and pretty, and her spoken English is not as good as Thanas's. She wants to come with us. Well, this could get complicated. Tom glances at me and shrugs. I haven't got time to argue. I'm not sure how long we're going to be, I state as I finish my coffee. It could double as paint stripper. I don't think I've ever drunk coffee this strong. It's cool. I've cleared my schedule for the week, Thanas responds. I've never been to Kukës myself, but Drita has. What do you know of Kukës? I ask Drita directly. She gives Thanas a nervous glance. That bad? I eye them both. It has a reputation. When the communists fell, Albania was... Thanas pauses. It went through a difficult time. Tom rubs his hands. I love a challenge, he says, and Thanas and Drita have the grace to laugh. We shall be okay with the weather, Thanas says. The motorway is open, and it hasn't snowed for a couple of weeks. Shall we get going? I ask, eager to leave.
The landscape has changed. Gone are the dreary, fallow fields of northern Europe. The terrain is stark, rocky, and barren in the winter sunshine. Under any other circumstances, Alessia might have enjoyed this journey. She's had a lightning tour of Europe's highways. But she's with Anatoly, the man she'll be forced to marry, and she still has to face her father when they reach Kukës. She's not looking forward to the inevitable confrontation, and deep down she knows it's because her mother will bear the brunt of his anger. They tear across another bridge at an alarming speed. Below them is a vast body of water, reminding Alessia of the Drin, and reminding her of the sea. The sea, and Maxim. He gave me the sea. Will she ever see him again?
The coastline in Croatia is very picturesque, I do a lot of business here, says Anatoly, breaking the silence that's hung between them since they left Zagreb. Alessia glances at him. She doesn't care about his business. She doesn't want to know what he does. There was a time when she was curious, but that time has passed. Besides, as his wife, a good Albanian wife, she will ask no questions. I have several properties here. He gives her a wolfish grin, and she realizes he's trying to impress her, like he did when she first met him. She turns away, staring out at the sea, and her mind spirals back to Cornwall.
The drive out of Tirana is frankly terrifying. Pedestrians have an unnerving habit of just stepping out into the road, and the roundabouts are free-for-alls. Cars, trucks, buses, all jostling for priority. It's like a giant game of chicken. And at this rate, my nerves will be in shreds by the time we reach Kukës. Tom is constantly slamming his hand on the dashboard, yelling at pedestrians and drivers alike. It's bloody annoying. For fuck's sake, Tom, shut the fuck up. I'm trying to concentrate. Sorry, Trevethick. By some miracle, we make it out of the city centre unscathed. Once we reach the main road, I start to relax a little, but I drive slowly. Drivers here are unpredictable. There are several car dealerships and countless petrol stations on the roadside. As we leave Tirana behind, we pass a grand, imposing neoclassical building that looks rather like a wedding cake. What's that place? I ask. It's a hotel, Thanas says. It's been under construction for many years. He shrugs when our eyes meet in the rearview mirror. Oh. The lowlands look fertile and green, considering it's February. There are squat, red-roofed houses dotted among the fields. While I drive, Thanas gives us a potted history of Albania and shares more information about himself. His parents lived through the fall of communism, and both of them learned English via the BBC World Service, even though it was banned under communist rule. It transpires that the BBC, and most things British, are held in high regard by Albanians. It's where they all want to go, there or America. Tom and I exchange a glance. Drita speaks quietly to Thanas, and he translates. Kukës was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2000, after the town accepted hundreds of thousands of refugees during the Kosovan conflict. This I knew. I remember Alessia's look of pride when she regaled me about Kukës and all things Albanian in the pub in Trevethick. It's been 2 days since she left, and I feel like I'm missing a limb. Where are you, my love? We join the main motorway to Kukës, and soon we are flying into the chilliest of blue skies, steadily climbing higher and higher toward the majestic, snow-capped peaks of the Albanian Alps and the Shar and Korab mountain ranges that dominate the landscape. There are gorges with clear whitewater rivers, craggy canyons, and steep, jagged cliffs. It's stunning, and apart from this modern motorway, the land around us seems untouched by time. There's an occasional hamlet with terracotta-tiled houses, smoke rising from chimneys, stooks of hay flecked with snow, washing on lines, goats free, goats tethered. This is Alessia's country. My sweet girl, I hope you're okay. I'm coming to get you. The temperature drops the higher we go. Tom has taken the wheel so that I can play DJ and take photographs with my phone. Thanas and Drita are quiet, enjoying the views and listening to Hustle and Drone, who are streaming through the car stereo system from my iPhone. We emerge from a long mountain tunnel to find we're right among the peaks. They're covered with snow, but are surprisingly bare, with very few trees. Thanas explains that after the communist regime fell, there were fuel shortages, and in some places the locals cut down all the trees for firewood. I thought we were high enough to be above the tree line, Tom says. In the middle of this rocky wilderness, we encounter a toll booth, and while we queue up behind a few battered cars and trucks, my phone buzzes. I'm amazed I can get a signal in these mountains on top of Eastern Europe. Oliver, what's up? I'm sorry to interrupt your day, Maxim, but the police have been in touch. They were rather hoping to interview your, fiancé, Mr. Marchi. Ah, so now he knows. I ignore the fiancé part of his statement. As you know, Alessia has returned to Albania, so they'll have to wait until she comes back to London. I thought as much. Did they say anything else? They have recovered your laptop and some sound equipment. That's good news. And the case is now in the hands of the Metropolitan Police. It appears that Mr. March's assailants are known to the police and wanted in connection with other crimes. The Met? Good. Sergeant Nancarrow said those arseholes might have form. Tom gives me a sideways glance. Have they been charged? As far as I know, not as yet, sir. Keep me up to date with these proceedings if you can. I want to know if they're charged and if they make bail. Will do. Just relay my message to the police about Mr. Marchi. Say she's had to return to Albania for a family matter. Everything else okay? Tickety-boo, sir.
Tickety-boo?
I snored. Great. I hang up and pass Tom €5 to pay for the toll. If Dante and his accomplice are still in custody, the police must be treating this seriously. Maybe they've got them for trafficking. I hope so. I hope they lock the fuckers up and throw away the key. A short while later, we see a sign for Kukas and my spirits lift. We're nearly there. Soon we're driving alongside a huge lake, which, when I consult my Google Maps, turns out to be a river. The Drin, which feeds Fierza Lake. I remember Alessia talking with such passion about the landscape around her town. My anticipation is growing exponentially. I urge Tom to drive faster. I am going to see her. I am going to save her. I hope. She might not need saving. She might want to be here. Don't think that. As we round a sweeping curve of the motorway, Kukas finally comes into view. It's nestled in the valley, with a wide blue-green river lake in front of it and ringed by dramatic mountains. The vista is spectacular. Wow. This was Alessia's view every day. We cross a sturdy bridge over the water. On a bluff above, a ghostly abandoned building stands sentinel, and I wonder if it's another unfinished hotel.
On the outskirts of Niksic in Montenegro, Anatoly pulls into the parking lot of a roadside cafe. Alessia stares listlessly out the window.
I'm hungry. You must be too. Let's go, he says.
Alessia doesn't bother to argue, but follows him into the pleasant, clean space. It's relatively new and decorated with a fun theme, automobiles. A cherry red hot rod is painted above the bar. It's an inviting place, but not for Anatoly. He's irritable. He's slapped the steering wheel several times and sworn loudly in the last couple of hours, infuriated by other drivers. He is not a patient man.
Order something for both of us. I'm going to the restroom. Don't run. I'll find you.
He scowls at Alessia and leaves her to choose a table. She's now keen to make it home. Given how Anatoly behaved yesterday evening, she doesn't want to spend another night with him. She'd rather face her father. She skims the menu, trying to find common words that she might recognize in either English or Albanian, but she's tired and can't seem to concentrate. Anatoly returns. He looks tired. Of course, he's been driving constantly for several days now, but Alessia refuses to feel any sympathy for him.
What did you order? He snaps.
I haven't. Here's the menu. She hands it to him before he can gripe. A waiter joins them, and Anatoly orders without asking her what she wants. She's amazed that Montenegrin seems to be yet another language he speaks fluently. The waiter scuttles away, and Anatoly pulls out his mobile phone. Cool blue eyes meet hers.
Keep quiet, he says, and he dials a number.
Good afternoon, Shpresa. Is Yak there?
Mama! Alessia sits up, fully engaged. He's talking to her mother.
Oh. Well, tell him we'll be home around 8 this evening.
Anatoly's eyes slide to Alessia.
Yes, she's with me. She's Well, no, she's in the restroom.
What? Anatoly puts his index finger to his lips. Anatoly, let me talk to my mother, Alessia insists, holding out her hand for the phone.
We'll see you then. Goodbye.
He hangs up.
Anatoly!
Tears of anger threaten as a lump swells in her throat. She's never felt as homesick as she does now.
Mama.
How could he begrudge her a few words to her mother?
If you were a little more docile and grateful, I would have let you talk to her, he says. I have come a long way for you.
Alessia glares at him, then drops her eyes. She doesn't want to meet the challenge in his. She cannot bear to look at him after this latest outrage. He's cruel and vindictive and petulant and childish. Fury quietly seeps into every vein in her body. For all that he's done, she will never forgive him. Ever. Her only hope is to plead with her father and beg him not to force their marriage.
Close up, Kukus is not what I thought it would be. It's a nondescript town of weathered Soviet-style apartments built in blocks. Drita informs us via Thanas that it was constructed during the 1970s. The original old town of Kukus is now at the bottom of the lake. The valley was flooded to feed the hydroelectric dam that provides power to the surrounding region. The roads are lined with fir trees, there's a blanket of snow on the ground, and the streets are quiet. There are a few shops, selling household goods, clothes, and farm equipment, and a couple of supermarkets. There's a bank, a pharmacy, and many cafes, where, as is customary, men sit outside in the afternoon sunshine, wrapped up against the chill, drinking coffee. Again, where are all the women? The most distinctive feature of the town is that at the end of each street, wherever I look, the mountains stand tall and proud in a dramatic backdrop. We are surrounded by their majestic beauty, and I find myself wishing I'd brought my Leica. My travel agent has booked us into a hotel called, of all things, America. Google Maps guides us through the back streets to the hotel itself. It's a curious mix of old and modern, with an entrance that looks like a Christmas grotto, especially now as it's dusted with snow. Inside, it has to be one of the kitschiest places I've ever seen, crammed with touristy knickknacks procured from the USA, including several plastic statues of Liberty. The decor is impossible to define, a mishmash of styles, but the overall effect is cheery and friendly. The host, a wiry, bearded man in his 30s, is warm and welcoming, and greets us in a broken version of English before ushering us upstairs to our rooms via a tiny lift. Tom and I take the twin room, leaving the double for Thanas and Drita. Will you ask him for directions to this place? I hand Thanas a crumpled piece of paper with Alessia's parents' address. Yes. What time would you like to go? 5 minutes. Just give us time to unpack.
Steady on, Trevethick,
butts in Tom. Can't we have a drink first? As my father would say, some Dutch courage always helps. A quick one, and just one, okay? I'm going to meet my future wife's parents. I don't want to be stocious. Tom nods enthusiastically and claims the bed nearer the door. I hope to God you don't snore, I say as I unpack. An hour later, we are parked in a small lay-by that leads to two open rusty metal gates. Beyond, down a concrete driveway, is a solitary terracotta-roofed house on the banks of the Drin. Only the roof is visible. Thanas, you'd better come with me, I say, and we leave Drita and Tom in the car. The glow of the setting sun casts tall shadows across the driveway. We're on a large plot, surrounded by naked trees, though there are a few firs and a sizable, well-kept vegetable patch. The house is painted a pale green and has three stories and two balconies that face the water from what I can see. It's larger than the other houses we saw on our way here. Perhaps Alessia's folks are affluent. I have no idea. The lake looks magnificent, lit up with the hues of a fading winter sunset. On the outside of the house, there's a satellite dish, and it reminds me of a conversation I had with Alessia. And they've been to America by watching TV. American TV? Yes, Netflix, HBO. I knock on what I assume is the front door. It's made of a good, solid wood, so I knock again, harder this time, to be sure to be heard. My heart is pounding, and in spite of the cold, a trickle of sweat runs down my back. This is it. Game face on, dude. I'm about to meet my new in-laws, though they don't know that yet. The door half opens, and a chink of light behind her reveals a slight, middle-aged woman in a headscarf. In the fading evening light, I see that she's giving me a quizzical look, a little like Alessia. Mrs. DiMarchi? Yes? She looks bewildered. My name's Maxim Trevelyan, and I've come about your daughter. She gapes at me, blinking furiously, then opens the door a little wider. She's trim, with slight shoulders, and she's rather dowdily dressed in a voluminous skirt and blouse. Her hair is hidden beneath her headscarf, reminding me of the moment when I first saw her daughter standing like a frightened rabbit in my hallway.
Alessia,
she whispers. Yes. She frowns.
My husband is not here.
Her English sounds rusty, and her accent much thicker than her daughter's. She peers anxiously past me, scanning the driveway, for what, I don't know. And then she looks directly at me.
You cannot be here.
Why? I ask.
My husband is not at home.
But I need to talk to you about Alessia. I think she's on her way back here. She tilts her head, suddenly alert.
We are expecting her soon. You have heard she is returning.
My heart leaps in response. She's coming home. I was right. Yes. And I've come to ask you and your husband for... I swallow. For... permission to marry your daughter.
Our final border crossing, Carissima, Anatoly says. Back to your home country. Shame on you for leaving it and skulking away like a thief and dishonoring your family. When we return, you can apologize to your parents for the worry you have caused them. Alessia averts her eyes, inwardly cursing him for making her feel guilty for running away. She was running from him. She knows that many Albanian men leave their country to work abroad. For women, it's not so easy.
This is the last time you have to go in the trunk. But wait, I need to retrieve something first.
She stands back and looks west to where the sun has finally disappeared behind the hills. The chill in the air reaches through her clothes and entwines around her heart. And she knows it's because she's pining for the only man she'll ever love. Tears rise unexpectedly into her eyes, and she blinks them back. Not now. She doesn't want to give Anatoly the satisfaction. She will cry tonight, with her mother. She inhales deeply. This is what freedom smells like. Chilly, foreign. When she next takes a deep breath, she'll be in her homeland, and her adventures will become a... what did Maxim call it? A folly. From the past.
Get in. It will be night soon.
Anatoly snaps as he holds open the lid. The night belongs to the djinn. And she's staring at one now. That's what he is. The djinn personified. She climbs in without complaint and without touching him. She's getting closer to home, and for the first time, she's looking forward to seeing her mother.
Soon, Carissima, he says.
And there's a troubling glint in his eye.
Shut the trunk,
she responds as she clutches the flashlight. His lips lift in a sardonic smile, and he slams the lid down, leaving her in darkness.
Mrs. DiMarchi gasps, and with another quick and anxious glance past me, she steps aside.
Come in.
Wait in the car, I say to Thanas. And I follow her into a confined vestibule where she points to a shoe rack. Oh. Quickly, I slip off my boots,
relieved that I'm wearing matching socks, and that would be because of Alessia. The hall is painted white, its shiny tiled floor topped by a brightly coloured Kilim rug. She waves me on into an adjoining room where two old sofas covered in bold and colourful patterned blankets face each other across a small table that's also covered in a rich printed cloth. Beyond is a fireplace, its mantelpiece peppered with old photographs. I squint, hoping to see one of Alessia. There's one of a young girl, with large, serious eyes, seated at a piano. My girl. The grate is piled with logs, but they remain unlit in spite of the cold, and I suspect that this is the drawing room used to receive company. Pride of place is given to the old upright piano that sits against the wall. It's plain and shabby, but I bet it's tuned to perfection. This is where she plays. My talented girl. Beside the piano is a tall shelf stacked with well-thumbed books. Alessia's mother has not asked me to remove my coat. I don't think I'm going to be here for long.
Please, sit,
she instructs. I take a seat on one of the sofas, and she perches on the edge of the one opposite, radiating tension. Clasping her hands together, she stares at me expectantly. Her eyes are the same dark shade as Alessia's, but whereas Alessia's are full of mystery, her mother's hold only sadness. I guess it's because she's anxious about her daughter. But from her lined face and the sprinkling of grey in her hair, it's obvious she's not led an easy life.
Life in Kukas is hard for some women.
Alessia's quietly spoken words come back to me. Her mother blinks a couple of times. I suspect I'm making her nervous or uncomfortable, and for that I feel a little guilty.
My friend Magda, she writes to me about a man who helps my Alessia and also Magda herself. Is that you?
Her voice is hesitant and soft. Yes.
How is my daughter?
She whispers. She's studying me intensely, clearly desperate for news of Alessia. When I last saw her, she was fine. More than fine. She was happy. I met her when she worked for me. She came to my house to clean. I simplify my English, hoping Alessia's mother can keep up.
You have come all the way from England?
Yes.
For Alessia?
Yes. I've fallen in love with your daughter, and I believe she loves me too. Her eyes widen.
She does?
She looks alarmed. Okay, this is not the reaction I'd been expecting. Yes, she told me she does.
And you want to marry her?
Yes.
How do you know that she wants to marry you?
Ah. In truth, Mrs. DiMarchi, I don't know. I haven't had the chance to ask her. I believe that she's been kidnapped and is being brought to Albania against her will. She leans her head back, her eyes intense, assessing me.
Shit. My friend Magda speaks well of you, she says. But I don't know you. Why would my husband let you marry our daughter?
Well, I know she doesn't want to marry the man her father has chosen for her.
She says this to you?
She's told me everything. And what's more, I listened. I love her. Mrs. DiMarchi bites her upper lip, and the mannerism is so reminiscent of her daughter that I have to hide my smile.
My husband will return soon, and it is for him to decide what will become of Alessia. His mind is set on her betrothed. He has given his word.
She looks down at her clasped hands.
I let her go once, and it broke my heart. I don't think I can let her go again.
Do you want her to be trapped in a violent, abusive marriage? Her eyes whip to mine, and in them I see a glimpse of her pain and her insight, swiftly followed by her shock that I know this is her life. Everything that Alessia ever said about her father comes back to me, Mrs. DeMarchi whispers,
You must go. Go now.
She stands up. Fuck. I've offended her. I'm sorry, I say, as I stand too. She frowns, looking momentarily confused and undecided. Then suddenly she blurts out,
Alessia will return here at 8 o'clock this evening with her betrothed.
She averts her eyes from mine for a moment, probably wondering if it was a good idea to impart this state secret. Reaching out, I want to squeeze her clasped hands in gratitude, but I stop myself, as my touch may not be welcome. Instead, I give her my most sincere and grateful smile. Thank you. Your daughter means the world to me. She thaws briefly, rewarding me with a hesitant smile of her own, and again I see a little of Alessia in her. She shows me to the door, where I slip on my boots, and she ushers me out.
Goodbye,
she says. Are you going to tell your husband that I've been here?
No.
Okay, I understand. I offer what I hope is a reassuring smile, and I head back to the car. Back at the hotel, I'm restless. We've tried watching TV. Neither Tom nor I understand what we're watching. We've tried reading, and now we're in the bar. It's on the roof and would offer an impressive daytime view of Kukus, the lake, and the surrounding mountains, but it's dark, and the dimly lit vista offers no solace for me.
She's on her way home. With him. I hope she's okay.
Sit down. Maybe have a drink, Tom says.
I give him a sideways look. It's at times like this that I wish I smoked. The anticipation and the tension are almost unbearable. After one slug of whiskey, I can bear no more. We're going.
It's too early.
I don't care. I can't stay cooped up here waiting. I'd rather wait with her folks. At 7:40, we return to the DeMarchi house.
Time to be a grown-up.
Tom waits in the car once more with Drita, while Thanas and I walk down the driveway.
And remember, I've not been here before. I don't want to get Mrs. DeMarchi into trouble, I say to Thanas.
Trouble? With her husband.
Oh, I understand.
Thanas rolls his eyes.
You understand?
Yes. Life is different in Tirana. Here it's much more traditional. Men, women.
He grimaces. I wipe my sweaty palms on my coat. I haven't felt this nervous since my interview for Eton. I have to make a favorable impression on Alessia's father. I need to persuade him that I'm a better option for his daughter than the asshole he's chosen. That's if she wants me.
Shit.
I knock on the door and wait. Mrs. DeMarchi answers the door. Her eyes flit from Thanas to me. Mrs. DeMarchi? I ask, and she nods.
Is your husband at home?
She nods once more, and in case we're overheard, I replay the introduction I made to her earlier in the day, as if it hadn't happened.
Come in, she says. You must speak to my husband.
Once we've removed our shoes, she takes our coats and hangs them in the hall. Mr. DeMarchi stands when we enter a larger room at the back of the house. It's an airy, spotless kitchen-come-living room, the two areas separated by an arch. A pump-action shotgun hangs ominously on the wall above Mr. DeMarchi's head. I note that it's within easy reach. DeMarchi is older than his wife. His face is weather-beaten, his hair more grey than black. He wears a somber, dark suit that lends him the air of a mafia don. His eyes give nothing away. I'm glad he's half a head shorter than me. As Mrs. DeMarchi quietly explains who we are, his expression becomes more and more mistrustful.
Shit. What is she saying?
Thanas whispers a running commentary.
She's telling him that you wish to speak to him about his daughter.
Okay. DeMarchi gives us both an uncertain smile as he shakes our hands in turn, then waves at an old pine couch, inviting us to sit. He appraises me with shrewd eyes, the same shade as Alessia's, while Mrs. Demarchi wanders through the arch into the kitchen. Demarchi looks from me to Thanas and starts to speak. His voice has a rich, deep timbre that's almost soothing to listen to. Thanas immediately starts to translate for both of us.
My wife tells me you are here because of my daughter.
Yes, Mr. Demarchi. Alessia worked for me back in London.
London?
He looks impressed for a moment, but the shutters come down quickly.
What did she do exactly?
She was my cleaner. He closes his eyes for a moment, as if this news is too painful to hear, which surprises me. Or perhaps he thinks this is beneath her. Or maybe he misses her. I don't know. I take a deep breath to calm my spiraling nerves and continue. I have come to ask for her hand in marriage. His eyes pop open in surprise, and he scowls. It's an exaggerated expression, but I don't know to what end.
She's already promised to another, he says.
She does not wish to marry that man. He is the reason that she left here. Demarchi's eyes widen at my outspoken candor, and I hear a small gasp from the kitchen.
Did she tell you this?
Yes. Demarchi's expression is inscrutable. What the hell is he thinking? The creases in her father's forehead deepen.
Why do you wish to marry her?
He seems perplexed. Because I love her.
Kukis is achingly familiar, even in the dark. Alessia is both excited and apprehensive about seeing her parents. Her father will beat her. Her mother will hold her in her arms, and they will cry together, like they always do. Anatoly drives over the bridge to the Kukis Peninsula and turns left. Alessia sits up, straining to catch a first glimpse of home. Less than a minute later, she sees the lights of her parents' house and frowns. There's a car parked near the end of the drive with two people leaning against it, facing the river and smoking. Alessia thinks it's odd, but dismisses the thought, too preoccupied by her imminent reunion with her parents. Anatoly steers the Mercedes around the parked car and down the driveway. Before the car has come to a complete stop, Alessia flings open the passenger door and flies up the path and through the front door. Without taking off her shoes, she races down the main hallway. Mama, she calls, and she bursts into the living room, expecting to see her mother. Maxim and another man she barely notices stand. They had been sitting with her father, who is now staring up at her. Alessia's world stops, and she freezes as she tries to process what she's seeing. She blinks a couple of times as her empty, aching heart kickstarts back into life. She has eyes for only one man. He's here.
Chapter 31. My heart is beating a frantic tattoo. Alessia stands in the middle of the room, astounded. She's here. She's finally here. Dark, dark, wide eyes stare back at me in disbelief. Yes, I came to get you. I've got you. Always. She looks stunning. Slender, sweet, her hair wild, but her skin is pale, paler than I've ever seen her before. And she has a graze on one cheek and a bruise on the other. There are dark circles beneath her eyes that are shining with unshed tears. A lump forms in my throat. What have you been through, sweetheart? Hello, I whisper. You left without saying goodbye.
Maxim is here. For her. Everyone else in the room disappears. She can see only him. His hair is tousled. He looks pale and tired, but relieved. His startling green eyes drink her in, and his words touch her soul. The same words he used when he came to find her in Brentford. But there's a question on his face, beseeching her. It's asking why she left. He doesn't know how she feels about him, but he came anyway. He's here. He's not with Caroline. How could she doubt him? How could he doubt her? She lets out a small, sharp cry and races into his waiting arms.
Maxim cradles her against his chest, holding her tightly. She inhales his scent. It's clean.